Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Meta won't algorithmically share political content with you in threads from accounts you don't already follow. The question is, do we trust Meta to determine what content is and is not political? Score is a new dating app conceived at last year's AfroTech, and it requires you to have a credit score of 675 or better in order to find a match. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman seeks a measly $7 trillion for a new AI chip project. And HBCUs could benefit from the CHIPS Act if the federal government adheres to its Section 104 provisions. We got all this and more for you on episode 117 of The Tech John. From Columbus, Ohio, I'm your host, Rob Dunwood.
And coming out of Philly, it's your girl, Tech Life Steph.
And out of Atlanta, this is Terrence Gaines, a.k.a. Brother Tech, a.k.a. Love is in the Air. Happy Valentine's Week for all those folks out there who choose to celebrate.
Let me take a note right now.
You're already late in the game.
Thank you for reminding. No, I'm just being facetious.
I was about to say.
No, I have calendar updates that notify me starting about 2-3 weeks out. Hey, Valentine's Day is coming up. Anyway, what's going on, y'all?
Nothing much. Nothing at all. Just got a lot of stuff going on. But other than that, ready to get into some tech news.
Let's dive into it. We will probably talk about the Super Bowl just a little bit in our after party, but let's go ahead and jump into these tech stories because we got a few of them. We want to get through them today. So the first one, Terrence, this one is yours. Do we trust Meta to keep our feeds politically free? That's how you title it. But this is stemming from something that came out last week where Meta basically said that with Threads, they are not going to promote any political content unless you already follow the account that is posting the political content. And at first, that seems like, okay, that's pretty cool. You want to keep all this trash that sometimes political content can be out of people's feeds. But then the question gets asked is like, well, who determines what the political content is and what's political? So it can be all kind of problematic. So I wanted to get you guys' take on just what do you think about what Meta is ultimately doing as far as Threads is concerned? And is it good for them to actually say what is political and what is not political?
So basically what they was doing prior to this announcement was, according to this blog post and from Meta, they said, we've shifted away from ranking political content in Facebook feed based on engagement signals, such as how likely you are to comment on or share content, since we found that they are not reliable indicators that the content is valuable to someone. So that automatically raises my eyebrows. Like, so y'all was ranking content? What kind of content was you ranking? Was it anything that's completely untruth? Or is it just Democrats versus Republicans or independent versus conservative versus liberal? It's like, okay, you're saying you are moving away from ranking the content. Well, what was y'all doing before?
Yeah.
Is my question to where the stuff got so crazy. Terry is like, well, maybe this is not a good idea. And then like Rob said, going forward, okay, so you're going to stop prioritizing or ranking or whatever you were doing, you know, so that goes to, all right, so what are y'all doing now? And then how y'all going to assume that this new way that you're doing political content is any different than what it was before? Number two, who's all going to do all this new ranking or however you're going to do it? Or are you just going to let it flow and then whatever happens, happens? All those situations spell trouble. But I guess the question is, what side of trouble does Meta want to be on?
Yeah, I don't think Meta needs to be in this business, basically. I mean, obviously these are their platforms. They need to take the responsibility of doing some sort of content moderation. But, you know, once you start asking these questions, like, content moderation is one thing, but determining, you know, the degree of politicalness of a post is something else entirely. You know what I mean? You're speaking now to trying to interpret intent in a post, which you're just, you know, you're horrible at. You know what I mean? You're horrible at getting the stuff that's obviously pornographic or obviously violent or obviously whatever. You can't even get that off your platform. So now you're going to get into this sort of nuanced detail. Yeah. Of what exactly is a political. And the only way you can do it right now is by looking for keywords, which just completely, you know, tosses the baby out with the bathwater in most cases. So this is not going to go well for them, for us who may want to see political content and want to be able to discover political content. Cause that's what it's going to do. It's going to take it out of the recommendations, area. So you won't be able to actually, you know, discover randomly this sort of content. And I mean, maybe I want to, like, how are you just keeping me from the content that I may want to see? It just is not going to go well. This is not going to go well.
I have several thoughts on this. So the first thing, and I actually wrote this, you know, who's to say, you know, who's making these rules? Well, Meta is. And to be fair to them, they are doing the exact same thing with Instagram and the exact same thing with Facebook. So this isn't any different for Threads. They're just now adding this thing to Threads. But Meta has said that, you know, from the beginning of Threads, they do not want it to be, you know, the place where politics is discussed. That's not what they're looking for. That causes them problems on the back end. So if they could get rid of all political speak, I don't think they really have a problem with it. But here's the question, though. What is political speech? It's like you get into, you have to now start defining these things. What is political content? Because some folks might say, you know, I would really like it if my children could read books that featured authors who look like them. That could be a very political statement, depending on what state you live in.
Right.
Pretty much all 50 of them. But yeah, that's a very political statement. So you could literally be just having conversations with your people about, man, they out here banning all these books. And I would just like, you know, where can I send my child to go read some stuff, you know, written by people about them or about experiences that would, you know, reflect them? Not necessarily a political statement, but who's going to determine if that's a political statement?
And there's no way to do this in a way that's going to be fair and equitable. And it's tap dancing on the violation of free speech line just a little bit. I mean, the fact that they're not necessarily banning this content, but they're doing everything they can to suppress it from people who could potentially see it, is right up there on the line of, you know, banning free speech, you know, for all intents and purposes, for as many people that won't get to see it. So it just reeks of failure to me, because there's just no way they can do this in a way that's going to make sense for, you know,
everybody,
the majority of people. Yeah.
Which is the problem. Ultimately, which is the problem with user generated content. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. Until these social media platforms either A, start charging people to use them, or figure out how to generate their own content that the masses then consume, there's no way they're going to be able to control the content because it's from the users. Facebook, if you add Meta, I mean, if you add Instagram, if you add Threads, if you add all the platforms, billions of people utilize these platforms. So how on earth are y'all going to be able to take all this content in and then try to massage it to where the majority of people say, that's okay, I'm okay with that? You can't. There's no possible way you can. So all these ways you're trying to do it is either A, going to be okay with some people and then piss everybody else off. Or, you know, there's some combination of that to where they're trying to either fix or just trying to tell us that they're fixing and they really ain't trying to do nothing because ultimately they can't because it's our content. And that's, you're always going to run into that trouble or that issue.
So here's a question. We respect Meta more if they just flat out came out and said, look, we don't want political content on our platform. It doesn't benefit us. We're not profiting off of it the way that we would like to. So we're just going to eliminate it in the best way that we can. I mean, if they said that, would we feel better about it? Or is it the fact that they're, oh, well, we're going to ban this. You know, we're going to call it political content. But like when I really think about this, it's going to be things that are not really political content. It's just that somebody felt that it was because of who said it or the way that they said it. Well, and you get into that gray area.
It's too subjective. That's the thing. Yeah. And you know, even if you were like, we're banning it, how? Banning it for, like, I look at, you know, Sean King. He's gotten a lifetime ban on Instagram. He's no longer on Instagram. And, you know, from what I understand of his content that I've engaged with, none of it should have violated their terms of service. I mean, because he wasn't specifically put, like, I don't know. There could have been a post that was calling for violence or whatever violates their terms, but all he tended to do in the content that I've seen him do was amplify what was already happening and give voice to people who you may not have heard on, you know, because their own following was small or whatever. Like, I haven't heard any misinformation necessarily. So I would be really interested in why, you know, something, you know, someone like him with such a large following would have been banned. And again, it goes back to, what are you calling political? Who's to say what's political and what's not political? I mean, obviously he's an activist, so all of his content is political, but in what way,
right,
is that political content violating any right. kind of policy? You know what I right. mean? Because it didn't appear so, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But again, everybody opinions are like assholes. You know what I mean? Everybody got one. And so somebody else might have looked at what he was posting and been like, oh, this is anti whatever and this is too pro whatever. But it's just too, again, subjective to for one body to make that call, especially a corporation, you know, who's in the business of capitalism and views and everything else. Like, you just, y'all are tainted. Y'all's opinion of what this is not objective enough to make that call.
Yep. And the whole point of social media is to give people a voice. Then how are you going to turn around and take it? Because you just don't like, you don't like, or somebody else reported right. that they don't like what the person said. Now, I get content that is violent, content that promotes violence, content that promotes and puts anybody in danger, you know, or just flat out misinformation, right? That's clear. That stuff should be out of there regardless of what it is, whether I agree with it or not. If I follow somebody and I happen to agree with what they say, but it just so happens to be, well, that was a non-factual, or, you know, somebody's been hurt as a result of it. I'm like, hey, you got to respect the game, but you can't really say that because, again, these social media platforms are all over the place based on how the wind blows, based on if somebody's looking at them for some strange reason. You know, they're just making these things up on the fly, which is never going to work because, like I said, these are people's voices. These are free platforms where people can share their voice. So for you to try to police that, good luck.
And especially considering that nowhere in the announcement did they say we're hiring X number more, you know,
moderators
to look at moderators, or we've partnered with this journalism project to vet this content and come up with these guidelines on what determines politics or not. You know, like you're not doing the work. You're just doing a lot of lip service to this issue without doing the actual work of trying to solve it in a way that makes sense for people.
Yeah, I think what they're doing is they're solving it the same way they solved it for Facebook and Instagram. But the reason that people seem to be a bit more up in arms about it is because Threads, regardless of what Facebook wants it to be, a lot of people are looking at it as a replacement for Twitter.
Yep.
And this is where that conversation thrived on Twitter. And now on X, it's still happening there on X. And I think that people are saying, it's like, where do I go for my news? Where do I go to hear this person? Where do I go to hear that person? Right. Or I guess in this case,
Adam Mosseri's like, not here. Don't bring that ish over here.
So to be clear, if you follow someone, if you follow an account that is putting out political information, you can then see the political information, but you have to follow the account. What's not going to happen is you're not algorithmically going to see things. What Meta is not going to do is see that you've been talking about a particular topic and then say, oh, well, you might be interested in these other topics, because if you've been talking about politics, which goes against
the entire structure of how these social networks were created in the first place. The whole point is to be a recommendation engine. And now you're going to reverse that and flip it and reverse it, basically, and not do that. So like, where they do that at? Going against your whole business model.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, because I don't have a dog in the hunt, so to speak. It's like, I don't really spend enormous amounts of time looking at political content on these platforms, but hundreds of millions of people do.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like, I understand from the company standpoint, it's like, this does us no good as a business to have this on our platform. I get that, but you also can't say, but we also want to be the platform where everybody comes to have conversation, except for these ones that we don't like. I don't want to call it a gray area or whatever area, but it is an area that is difficult to deal with. So I do understand why Meta would be doing these things, but I think on a platform like Threads, which is although Adam Mosseri will not say that it was a clone of Twitter, there's a lot of Twitter-like features that are in Threads. And there's a lot of features that people would like to be in Threads that are still in X, but are not over here right now. So it's one of those things to where I get where they're coming from. It's just going to be interesting to see how this works out. And who knows, maybe Blue Sky. I know I didn't put this in the rundown, but Blue Sky removed their sign up.
They cannot.
5 million folks now.
Facebook Meta is trying to police people's content
and play both sides of the fence while they're doing it. And you can't do it.
You're not going to be able to tell people what they can and can't do on a free site. As much as they want to try, as much as they want to moderate, as much as they want to police. Again, and I'm saying this because people are people. If we can't do it on Meta or Instagram or Facebook or Twitter, we're going to go to Threads. If we can't do it on Threads, we're going to go to Blue Sky. If we can't do it on Blue Sky, we're going to go to Mastodon. You can't do it on and so on and so on and so forth. So I think this is not a problem, not particularly a problem for social media to fix. They can try to do those things. Like I mentioned, as long as nobody's being directly hurt on the back of this, then that's an issue. As long as somebody's not promoting violence, that's an issue that's just a moral issue that we've all tried to work with. But social media ain't no better than the police, or ain't no better than the government.
Social media is no better than humans.
Exactly.
So, like, it is what it is.
Right.
And it allows you to find the worst of humanity with the speed of computers. Mm-hmm. Because here's the thing. People in public, like when you're out at the mall, although we will see folks acting stone cold fool at the mall, that's not the regular thing for folks at the mall. But when you're on social media, it's like 20% of folks is just outrageous with the stuff they say, because it's not a picture of them. It's an avatar. It's anonymous. You don't know who they are. So I'm not saying that everybody needs to be, tracked to that level. But I do understand that when it comes to social media, you're going to see the worst of humanity exposed quickly, just because it doesn't cost them anything to. All right. So this next story, Steph, this one is yours, because I don't think that Terrence or I, either one of us would have come up with this one, because we are both very, very happily married. But I'm looking at this story about this new platform, about this new dating site that I'm glad I ain't in the game anymore. So why don't you tell us a little bit about why you might need to have good credit to get a date or a score.
I'm just, and I'm not really mad at it, honestly, but yeah. Upon further review, it has become obvious to me that this is, you know, really more so a marketing, I don't want to say ploy, because, you know, some people could meet and hook up and get married and live happily ever after with bomb ass credit scores based off this app. However, again, just based off of, you know, more further research into the story, this does look like just a very, very good marketing effort on the part of this company. So, there is a company, a fintech company called Neon Money Club, which, by the way, has a black CEO. They're doing big things. They just raised, I think, $10 million in like a Series A recently. It's a legitimate company. They raised $10 million so far since the company started. But basically, what the app is doing is it's a financial platform that wants to raise awareness and help people with different sorts of financial technical products, but they launched a app called Score, which is a dating app that you have to have a minimum credit score to be on. I believe the minimum credit score is 675. And the whole point of the app is that we need to Luke Bailey is the CEO of Neon Money Club. He was quoted in TechCrunch as saying, "We need to take the conversation to areas where finance isn't traditionally discussed. Before you can educate people, you need to get their attention. With Score, we're bringing this conversation to dating, because, you know, it sometimes can be an uncomfortable conversation for people to have. You don't want to be on the first date talking about, you know, what's your credit score. However, you do want to, I personally would want to connect with somebody that I knew had some level of financial literacy about them and cared about where their finances were. And this is kind of a way, I think, to bridge that gap. The app is only going to be live for like 90 days from what, the article was saying. The app will be available for a limited time. Prospective users must apply to get access. I went on the site. I didn't want to entered that much of my personal information. Well, it said that the checking, they only want the last four digits of your social. Your name, address, last four digits of your social. They are saying that the check will not impact your credit score. Them, you know, doing the inquiry, they're doing like a soft inquiry, and it won't impact your credit score. And they're not necessarily trying to match you based on exact credit score. So like, you know, 800 to 800 or whatever, as long as you have a minimum score, you qualify to be on the app, and then y'all can kind of take it from there. But I was like, it's a very novel idea. And listen, I'm not super, super mad at it, although I'm aware that, you know, sometimes communities of color, you know, do fall on I don't want to say the lower end of the credit spectrum, but for reasons that have to do with institutional racism, sometimes fall below, you know, what their white counterparts end up at. So I think you do maybe lose a few people, you know, on that, because, you know, they did in the article, it did say he was asked about whether or not this was classist to have something like this, that could potentially exclude people from finding true love. But I mean, I'm not getting on it. I'll say all this to say I would not get on an app like this, but I'm also not necessarily mad at it, because I see what they're trying to do. What say you?
Go ahead, Rob.
So, my initial thought on this is like, seriously, this is what y'all doing now? This is what the dating world has come to. But then I thought, I actually have a friend who's now engaged. Who has actually used the services of an executive matchmaker. And it was a heck of a lot more than a credit check that they ran on her and then ran on the guy that she's now engaged to. It was a full you know, it was a full check. It was almost like an FBI level check. They wanted to make, you know, they wanted to know everything, you know, where you work history. Did you have any, you know, felonies, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know, things that you wouldn't necessarily talk about in your first couple of dates. And I remember having this conversation with her. She said, you know, why would she do that? It's just like, well, you know, at the time she was in her late 30s and I think she's just now like 40 or 41 and they're about to get married, but she's like, I don't have a lot of time. It's like, you know, I would like to meet someone. And if I can eliminate 3 months of the finding out who you are to where I can trust you. Cause it's like, you know, 3 months, that's just 12 dates, but that's still 3 months. It's like, do I got to go out with you 12, 15 times before I figure out that you can't hold a job, before I figure out
that crazy and drink.
You know, your house is not actually your house. It's your mama's house. And you just happen to live there with her. You know, and you position it as it was your house and she's living there with you. These kind of things I want to know up front because I just don't have time to deal with that. So when I thought about that conversation and I had, you know, with my friend, I was like, okay, yeah, I can see this because I have not been in the dating pool for a long, long, long time. But if I was right now, I'm thinking, yeah, I kind of want to know, do you work? do you have priors? These are the kind of things that I would want to, you know, get to know. And although I'm no longer looking to have any children or anything like that, it's just like, you know, you may not have a lot of time to deal with that 3 to 6 months just getting to know somebody before you decide whether or not you want to be in a relationship or something. So that's just my thought. I can see it. I can understand it.
It sounds like this app to me is in response to a lot of the conversations that I have seen, heard, or just witnessed online, to where money is becoming a big deal up front. I'm not saying it always was. It wasn't a big deal up front, but it seems like more so now, you know, people are starting to be more open about what they expect financially from a partner, from a potential partner, right? We've heard about the $200 dates and we've heard about where you where a man can and can't take a woman.
Can't
on
go
the first
to the
date.
Cheesecake Factory.
Woman, you know, the whole thing about, you know, would you date a dude who drives a bus? You know, all these things kind of go around finances, right? So it sounds like, and again, I could be totally wrong, but it sounds like an app like this is in response to those kind of conversations that we're starting to have online as it revolves around money. My only concern with this is, number one, I'm not sure if credit score is the right metric for you to kind of gauge how somebody is in a relationship as a whole. I know it's just a groundbreaker. I know it's just like a jumping off point. And then you're supposed to find out if that person's a good person, you know, outside of just them being good with money. Right. I get that. But at the same time, it's like something like this, almost once you get in, I can see people assuming that, oh, you know, well, this person, I don't know how they show the credit. I don't know if they even show credit scores at all. As when you're matching
somebody, they don't show each other. Okay. They don't show the scores to people. You just know that if
they have reached this threshold.
They've
gotten to the threshold of good credit. I think 675 is where good credit starts.
So. Right. So I guess my concern is to, and it had to be to the people who are actually using the app. You know, how much better or not is your potentials based off of this number, right? That could or could not be used. I've seen in many cases, people with excellent credit scores, terrible people, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, you know, ultimately what I'm getting at is I hope that somebody who would use this as a way to find a potential mate doesn't let their guard down because they perceived that this person is more compatible based off of this credit score thing that revolves around finances, which I get.
But it's a good way to weed folk out that aren't as responsible as you might be with your mm-hmm. finances. And if we can sort of start, you know, in a place where you're somewhat equally yoked, you know, because when you, and like you said, and like to Rob's point, y'all ain't out here on these app streets. Y'all do not see what I see in these app streets. So it's like, if you can at least start at a place where you're somewhat equally yoked, and if that means financially, because you both have some sense of financial responsibility, at least we are starting at a place. And yes, I agree with you, Terrence, that yes, you still got to do the work of getting to know this person for real, for real. But if we can at least start at a point where we are equally yoked in our financial understanding and literacy and goals and things like that, and then we can move forward from there. I mean, that's just one less thing you got to, you know, hope not to find out about, you know, right. Once you all in and you realize that this person, you know, got 12 years of child support on the back and, you know, and all this other stuff. So it's just, you know, one little way to weed out.
So Steph, you said at the very beginning that you did not want to call this a marketing ploy by the neon money club.
Neon
but
money
it
club.
Is.
So I'm not gonna make you do it. I'll go ahead and do it because it's a 90 day trial. And here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that so one of the things we didn't mention, this was actually, you know, they thought this up last year at Afrotech in Austin.
Yeah.
So my gut is telling me that they did this because, okay, you know what? Folks are saying this is what they want. We got all these coders here. Let's figure out, can we put something together to ultimately mm-hmm. get more people into the Neon Money Club?
Yeah, because absolutely.
Well, can we allow people meet each other in the Neon Money Club? Because that is, you know, an area where they have, you know, things that they have in common that they're interested in. And if we can, you know, maybe get things moving a little bit quicker by making sure everybody got a good credit score, then let's do it. I don't know that that's what it is, but that's kind of what it seems like it is.
It is. I'm going to read something to you. Let me read something to you real quick. It says, those denied access to SCORE will be sent to resources to improve their financial literacy and to credit builder Grow Credit to help them boost their credit scores. Afterwards, those people are sent back to us to qualify for our products. This is what Luke Bailey mm-hmm. said about the thing. So it is obviously a ploy, and they have there's a Spotify playlist that is connected to the app with slow jams and all kind of stuff. And then this company, Neon Money Club, actually has
other real products.
Yeah, they have a card. They have a collaboration with American Express, and they mm-hmm. have a cream card. And I was like, when I saw a cream, I was like, these better be black people and not just white people trying to capitalize off of Wu-Tang. But they have an actual card
with a
cream in color that, you know, is an Amex card that they, you know, are pushing as well. So it definitely is, you know, it's great marketing. They got some press around it just in time for Valentine's Day, but I thought it was just an interesting experiment in, you know, how people could connect in this day and age.
So like I said, this is just me now. I'm making up my whole dialogue in my head. You're at Afrotech. It's like, you're having these conversations probably at a place where there are sudsy beverages that are sold to people only mm-hmm. 21 or older. And it's like, man, it's like, we should build an app. And this is what they brainstormed.
And had a hackathon that night.
I was like, you know what? This might actually work. So I'm interested just to go back and see where this is after this 90 day trial mm-hmm. runs, because you cannot convince me that if it's not successful, they won't do more of it, because ultimately, like, I think this is to get folks into the back end. And there could be some good on this. It's like, I mean, there are financial advisors who will tell you, it's like, you shouldn't be dating right now. You shouldn't be. You should be working on getting your finances.
Susie Orman would tell you that real quick.
It's like, you know, you can't afford.
Stay single and stay your butt at home.
You know, you can't afford to be married. You can't afford to do this. And You know, you have $250,000 in credit card debt. You shouldn't be worried about how to get the house right now. You should be, and starting a family right now. You should be worried about how to get out from under all that debt. I'm not saying that that's for everybody, but I do know that that is some of the conversation that is out there around finances. So yeah, this is, like I said, you didn't want to say it. I will say it. This is marketing to get you into the Neon Money Club. I'm going to agree with Charles, though. That name is horrible. That name does seem like a pyramid scheme. Neon Money Club. But when so many of these types of clubs like this have names like that. But yeah, that does give me a little bit of pause when I just hear the name of it. But looking on the back end of it, it's like, no, this is a legitimate company with actual investors, and they have real financial products. So it'll be real interesting to see where this goes.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So speaking of money, did your boy Sam Altman just ask for $7 trillion? Trillion?
He did.
With a T?
He did. With a T.
So, Steph, this is another one of your stories, but basically, CEO of OpenAI, he basically has come out and said that in order to do the work that we want to do at OpenAI, we need significantly more world capacity in semiconductors. And he believes that $7 trillion ought to be is the number to do it. So I'll let you get into the story, but I just want folks to understand how much $7 trillion is. There are exactly two countries that could pay for this in a year. They are called the United States and China. That is it. No one else has a GDP of $7 trillion. In fact, there's only 19 countries that have a GDP of over $1 trillion. And then, of course, if you put the European, European Union together, theirs is quite large as well. But it's like two countries could actually pay for this by themselves. So I'm just like, you want $7 trillion?
No, it's crazy. World? And I only threw it in there because our main story was about semiconductors and what the United States is doing around it. And it just did, the audacity. But the crazy part is I feel like he'll probably get it. I mean, he's not going to get it all in one shot. He's getting in bed with folks over in the United Arab Emirates as his sort of primary, ask. And I feel like he might get it. I mean, if our country doesn't block that investment, because I have been hearing, listen to some podcasts and hear some news that, the United States may not allow this sort of investment to happen because it would be coming from the UAE and other Arab countries. But if our country allows it, I feel like he'll get it, which is insane because I feel like, you know, he was an evil genius that created this whole thing to do exactly what he's doing now, which is, you know, commercializing and militarizing artificial intelligence, to become general artificial intelligence. And this is, would just get us all one step closer, you know, to the Skynet we keep joking about. But with this type of investment, like it that becomes a reality sooner rather than later.
It just sounds like the stuff that the people who tried to get him out the game the first time was
were trying to avoid.
About.
Exactly. That's
exactly what they were trying to avoid. Exactly mm-hmm. what they were trying to avoid.
That's like, this here he comes. Let's go ahead and try to genius. Nip this in the bud. Yeah, try to nip it in the bud. But again, you know, money talks. So he was back in the seat. And now
cash
this
rules
is the next,
everything around me.
This is the next move. But I mean, I guess there's a case to where, you know, AI is limited by our manufacturing and producing as it relates to energy, as it relates to all those things that goes into creating chips. So, I mean, I guess that is a good argument to have. Again, a good argument to have in order to justify getting that much money. Now, whether or not AI is that important that there needs to be a whole overhaul in chip, you know, however, you know, the global semiconductor industry, is AI enough to do that? That remains the question. But I mean, somebody's got to ask.
I think it is. I think it is. Like I said, if our government allows it, I think he's going to get at least close. Like, no, I mean, I don't know that he'll get 5 to 7 trillion like he's asking for, but I think he will maybe be the first person to get a $1 trillion investment. And now we got to come up with a new name because unicorns were the $1 billion valuations. You know, we'll have to come up with a new name for his company, but to describe it, but I think he'll get $1 trillion.
And to be a little bit more clear, so although I don't think he would turn down $7 trillion if somebody wanted to offer that to him and his company, that's not exactly what he was asking for. He believes that there needs to be $7 trillion in investments into the industry of building right. semiconductors. So right. all of that, you know, combined. So it's not just one place. He's not talking about, yeah, let's just go build, let's go build a giant super foundry in the UAE. That's not what he's talking about. He's saying that we need to have foundries all over Earth that are doing this. We need to have people trained all over Earth that are doing this ultimately so that we can actually do the work that we want to do to make, Skynet actually possible.
And guess who's already on the ground floor of that? Sam Altman. Let me read this passage. In 2018, Altman personally invested in an AI chip startup called Rain Neuromorphics, based near OpenAI's San Francisco headquarters. And in 2019, just a year later, OpenAI signed a letter of intent to spend $51 million on guess whose chips? Rain's chips. In December, the U.S. compelled a Saudi Aramco-backed venture capital firm to sell its shares in Rain. So dude is like, he's like, let me get on the ground floor and do a startup that creates.
He's been playing chess for this whole time.
So if we don't see this coming,
he's been playing chess, not checkers. we all. Mm-hmm.
So, yep. And the thing is, $7 trillion, that is an astronomical number that no one can imagine how much money that is. But I mean, what is it? You know, it takes 1,000 million to be a billion. It takes 1,000 billion to be a trillion. He wants seven of them. That is just enormous amounts of money. As I said, the only countries on Earth that have a GDP larger than that are the United States and China. No one else has $7 trillion, you know, as an individual country.
But the precedent is there with NVIDIA. NVIDIA has a market cap of $1.72 trillion right now. Mm-hmm. You know, there really is no ceiling on how this is going to go. And it's the new gold rush, really. It really is a new gold rush, the semiconductor industry.
I'm glad you mentioned NVIDIA just now, because here are the U.S. companies that have above a $1 trillion market cap. Apple, what does Apple make? They're number one, Microsoft. What does Microsoft make? They're number two, Amazon. What does Amazon do? Now, a lot of us think of Amazon and get ordering stuff and coming to the house. That's not most of their business. It's AWS is where most of their business is coming from. You know, Google. What does Google do? And then Nvidia. They round out the top five, you know, as far as American companies that are actual $1 trillion market cap companies. And I believe that those five companies together are roughly $10.2 or $10.3 trillion. So you have to take the five biggest U.S. companies, put them together, and you still got $3 trillion left over, I guess, at the end. If they decide they don't want to pay people, they could probably pull something like that off. So this is an enormous, enormous amount of money. But the U.S. government is not thinking that he's wrong. I don't know that they want to do it the way that Sam Altman is saying that they want to do it. But we, a couple years ago, passed the acts. When I say we, I mean the Biden administration passed the CHIPS Act a couple years ago. And that's where we're going to, you know, head into our next story, because you know, the CHIPS Act, you know, just to give you a little bit of background on it, it was a program that got a lot of bipartisan support. And the reason was because we had this little thing called the global pandemic that happened. And during the global pandemic, supply chains shut down on Earth. And we realized right fast that we don't control the chips that we need. So basically, we weren't able to get the chips that we needed when we needed them. So that kind of scared the country. And it's sad that it takes, you know, like global catastrophes like that to actually make the country think about things. But it's like, oh no, we cannot be in a situation where we cannot get chips when we need to get chips. So they invested, I want to say, is it like $240 billion? Or it's not just the government, it's government and companies, but that's a quarter trillion. I mean, that ain't 7 trillion, but that's just one country saying we're going to do this because what we want to do is bring, you know, chip making to our shores. So what is 248?
I think it was 240.
Okay.
So that was the number. Yeah.
That is still a awfully, awfully big number. But why do I bring this up? Because, you know, the story as far as how we're affected, HBCUs are gearing up for the global chip competition through a new partnership with the Biden administration. Now, I don't want to say that the Biden administration is going to take money and just go fund HBCUs, directly. But last Friday, the Biden administration announced $5 billion, that is going to come from CHIPS Act funds. So that $248 billion is going to go to semiconductor related research, development, and workforce needs, most of which is slated for the National Semiconductor Technology Center. And the NSTC is absolutely working with HBCUs to say, hey, you have an enormous amount of black engineers that come out of your school. We have already admitted in multiple ways that we have underfunded these HBCUs, intentionally so in many cases, to their detriment. And to rectify that, as part of the CHIPS Act, they had to go back and look at underserved communities. So that's something that they have to do. So I started tying all this together. And it's like, okay, well, why are they looking specifically at HBCUs? As well, about 10% of black graduates go to HBCUs, but about over 50%, actually most is what the article says, but over 50% of the ones who have the engineering degrees and the chops that they can actually go get these jobs working in foundries and building foundries and doing all this stuff that the CHIPS Act is trying to help us do, half of them come from HBCUs. So it only makes sense that, well, wait a minute, if half the engineers that are black, that are coming out of college, that can actually do these jobs or come from HBCUs, when only 10% of them are graduating from those schools, maybe we should look and see what those schools are doing special. They're turning out such high caliber engineers that can go and do this work. We can solve two problems with one, you know, maybe with one program. We can actually go and look and say, wait a minute, if we put our money here, something that we legally are entitled to do and have actually come out and said that we are not doing, maybe we can actually help this problem, because the issue right now is that with all of these, you know, investments like with Intel, and TSMC and, you know, some of the other the other companies that are in active construction right now, as far as building these foundries, a couple of them have had to slow down because it's like, well, we don't have people who can come in and do the work. We literally have the money to do what we need to do. We don't have the people that are trained to be able to do the jobs in the places where we're building the foundries. And this could go a long way to actually help with that. So that was a long setup. I don't want to make you guys have to read through all of that, but I kind of want to get your take on how do you think this might work as far as, you know, HBCU specifically getting some of this money coming from the CHIPS Act.
Oh, go ahead, Steph.
No, I read through the article and I also took a look at a little bit of the actual act itself. And there were a couple things, you know, I always want to be optimistic that, you know, the system is altruistically perpetuated throughout history and all that good stuff. But I can't help but wonder, in my Carrie Bradshaw voice, and you know, how much of this is due to them not being able to get as many H-1B visas, here anymore. And now it's like, we can't import the talent. So now we got to scramble and let's kind of, I don't want to say throw crumbs, because, you know, $5 billion is not crumbs, but over the larger scope of the project, you know. So I don't know. I want to just, you know, receive this news with the spirit in which it was given, but the cynic in me just won't do that. And then two, it looks like there's a provision in the bill that prevents these companies from offering lower cost semiconductors or products in general at their other global locations. Cause that was my whole thing. I'm like, okay, that's cool. Y'all building all these companies, you know, these facilities in the United States in order to build these semiconductors. But what's the incentive for companies to buy them from the companies in the United States? Because I have to believe that they're going to cost more money, because you're going to have union workers in these factories that you don't have in the Foxconns of the world. So what is the incentive for Apple to buy the semiconductors that TSMC makes in Kentucky versus the ones they make in Taiwan? I mean, I think if I read it correctly, there's a clause in there that says that the companies can't offer cheaper products elsewhere for like 10 years if they go into this program to get these subsidies. But I still feel like, you know, companies being what they are and $1 billion companies being $1 billion companies, they'll find a way to get around this. And, I don't see, you know, the Apples of the world buying more expensive product just because it was made in the United States. I see Apple doing that. I'll take that back. I do see Apple. I don't see anybody else doing that.
Well, I guess I was going to ask the question, is this new CHIPS Act a direct response or in partnership? I was reading through the article and it says the HBCU CHIPS Network, which is unaffiliated with the Commerce CHIPS for America under the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Is this article, or are we making the assumption that this announcement from the federal government is automatically or had in its mind where it was going to disseminate and distribute some of this money? One of those big groups was the HBCU CHIPS Network, or are we assuming that since Biden announced this, this group has the most opportunity or ventures to gain, or gets them the ability to get in on the ground floor where otherwise we wouldn't even be offered an option, I guess is my question. Because it sounds like the way the article reads, it sounds like the government has partnered with these HBCU groups, but when in actuality they haven't. And if they haven't, or if they have, what is the ironclad statement or argument or agreement that says this HBCU CHIPS network is going to benefit from this Biden's CHIPS and Science Act.
We're talking about getting money to HBCUs. There's no ironclad agreement, because even the ones that we thought were ironclad are not lived up to. But I think what's happening right here is that you actually have the administration saying, you know, people in the administration who, although the two groups are disparate, they're not related with each other, are saying, hey, we need to go work there, because here's two problems that we have. Stephanie, you're absolutely right. There are not enough H-1B visas to bring folks in who have these skills to work in the foundries that we're building here. We just don't have enough of those visas.
Rick, before you go further, is it a specific skill, or is it the economical benefit to bring in people with H-1B-1 visas? Let me say it a better way. Trying to bring in cheap labor, or are they trying to bring in specialized skilled labor?
They're trying to bring in specialized skilled labor. We literally do not have enough people to do these jobs. There are not enough Americans that have the skill set to fill up the foundries that we're building. Like, you know, there's an Intel facility being built literally 15 miles from my house. One of their biggest concerns, we hear this on the news regularly, we just don't have enough people to, you know, put into these jobs. So they've got all kind of programs where they're literally trying to grab folks from other parts of the country to get them to come and move to Columbus, Ohio.
Well, why would they do that? Why don't they just train the people that's already there?
Well, that's just it. We don't have folks that are going into it.
So in the state of Ohio, there's not enough people that can get ramped up in the 1 to 5 years it would take this foundry to get off the ground.
There are, but people don't look at jobs like that. You don't look at as a junior or senior in high school about, oh, you know what? Intel is building this foundry. Let me go into this job, you know, area for my 4 years of college, so that when I graduate, I can go work specifically at Intel. There are some folks that I'm imagining that are that ambitious that will do that, but there just aren't enough of them. We aren't pumping out enough people with the skill set to basically do, you know, much of this high tech work that is often done at the Foxconns of the world and done in South Korea and, you know, in other places like that. So what generally happens is that when you know that you've got jobs that you need to fill, you've got to put programs in place to get people to fill the jobs. So the government is trying to get anybody, American, at least anybody inside of these lower 48. I don't know that they're doing anything in Alaska. I haven't heard about that, but I'll just say the lower 48. That's where we're generally building these foundries. They want anybody that's here to be eligible for those jobs, but they know that they can't just say, hey, we're going to have these jobs available in 2 to 3 years on your own. Go get trained for them. Why, the government's saying we need to put stuff in place that we know that we're going to have people to go and do some of these jobs. So it's not just like the government is just looking at HBCUs, they're looking at colleges all over the United States. But to solve another issue is that what they're saying is that, well, wait a minute, when we look at, because there is a provision, it's called Provision 104 of the CHIPS and Science Law. It mandates efforts to establish activities that engage economically disadvantaged individuals. That is actually written into the law. So what they're saying is that, well, wait a minute, we know that we have to, by law, look at,
they're trying to kill disadvantaged, two birds with one stone.
With one stone. And it's like, and here's what we also know, even though these HBCUs are radically underfunded, they are churning out 50% of the black engineers in the United States as far as that are coming out of college every year. So if we partner with them and they're already churning out, you know, folks at that clip, at that rate, once again, 10% of graduates come out of HBCUs, over 50% of graduates with these high tech degrees come out of HBCUs. So
that's the problem too, because they're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart, because it's the actual right thing to do, because you've been underfunding deliberately and maliciously and intentionally to right that wrong. You're doing it because it's convenient to do, to use as a mechanism to right that wrong while you still reap all of the benefit of the talent that you want to extract from those universities. So it's like, you know, I guess the ends justifies the means, I suppose, because the schools are going to get the money. And I mean, I'm sure somebody listening right now is like, damn it, the school's getting the money. Just, you know, be shut up about it. But it's still, you know, it doesn't leave space for the actual wrong to be corrected and acknowledged and for somebody to be held accountable for the initial wrong. I think we kind of gloss over that when we do it this way because the country still gets the benefit.
And not only that, Stephanie, ain't no guarantee they're going to get the money. Number two, just cut the check, man. You talking about just right cut and wrongs, the check. And you talking about putting programs together, partner with these HBCUs and said over the next 5 years, we're going to give $50 billion, whatever the number is. We're going to create programs or not just on your own. Once you graduate from college and get the degree, then you can apply in the hopes of getting this job at this new foundry that makes these new Ripple. No, say, look, from ninth grade, you can apply for this program. And if you get in this program, we're going to build you up to where once you get to a competency level, whether that's high school diploma, whether that's college diploma, whether that's master's degree, whatever it is, once you go through this program, then you're automatically slated for XYZ, ABC, whatever the case may be. It sounds like to me, they just want to announce something. And then wherever direction goes, but you can't take away the fact that it announced it, Jack.
Well, and then it's like, to your point, we had the HBCU has their CHIPS network. So, you know, you can presume some of that money would have filtered down to that network anyway, and you would still reap the benefit, but you're just trying to get away with not actually having to admit the wrongdoing of underfunding the schools in the first place. And you're trying to slide the money in on the low, so and not take accountability for what you did all these years. And it's just, it's
stopping them from getting money.
So yeah, I will say a couple things. I don't know that it's that, because things that I will never do. I will never assume that the government or companies will do what is best for the people before they do what's best for them. I also believe that a broke clock is right twice a day.
Right.
So if this money comes to these schools, so things that we know, the report is saying that we have, underfunded HBCUs diabolically. So I'm adding in diabolically. That's my own adjective, but they are saying that they have done so, intentionally. Mm-hmm. To make sure that these schools can't compete on the same playing field as other state universities. It's like folks want to, a lot of people will look at, HBCUs like they shouldn't be getting. It's like HBCUs, if they're, most of them are state schools. They are entitled to the same money, to the same dollars as other state schools. But there have been so many rules and regulations they've put on HBCUs, even when it comes to like the amount of land they can buy in the towns that they're in, where they're constricted by not being able to expand, where other state schools that are not HBCUs and literally in the same cities don't have that. There's so many things that have happened. We're not, litigating all that. We know that they have been treated. They have lost, multiple lawsuits. The federal government has, state governments have, about how they're not doing right by their HBCUs, which is one of the reasons why Provision 104 is actually built into this. Well, so with that being said, it's like, it doesn't matter to me at this point that if this money comes because the law said you had to, it doesn't matter to me. It's like, well, the only reason you're doing this is because you couldn't hire enough people coming from outside of the country to come in and do these jobs. So you've got to give it to, you've got to train people inside of the country to do it. That doesn't matter to me, so long as the folks who look like us are getting an opportunity to go into these fields, because the programs are not actively working against us. In this case, they may actually work for us. That may be pie in the sky from my standpoint, but like I said, I am not disillusioned. I don't think that the government is doing this because, we really need to do something that's going to help these HBCUs out. Like, no, the government is like, we realize the spot we're in, and how bad it was, you know, for us during the pandemic. And we cannot be there because this is messing with our national security. It's not just about being able to help OpenAI build really cool chatbots. It is not just about having really cool phones you can walk around in your pocket, walk around with in your pocket. This goes to national security. You know, the military, they need AI. They need these chips to basically build guidance control systems for all the things we have that shoot things down, pretty much everywhere, around this planet. So there is a lot that we're saying that we're not going to be in a situation where we're just not going to be able to compete with the rest of the world. And the thing about 10 years, this is a long play. It takes 5 years to build these foundries. So if you're telling Intel, if you're telling Marvell Technology, if you're telling TSMC, you can't for 10 years, sell your stuff overseas more, sell stuff overseas undercut more expensively than you can sell it here. You can't undercut. It's like, okay, well, it's going to take us 5 years to get the thing built before we can even, have the capacity anyway. And we got another 5 years to get $250 billion. Right. Okay. We're cool with it. Why? Right. Because ultimately that's going to bolster their bottom line. And, 10 years is a long time. That is, that is a presidential cycle and two presidential cycles and a half, with 10 years. So from where I'm sitting is like, I, like I said, Steph, I don't believe that we're doing this because, well, we're doing this because this is just what's right.
No, absolutely.
It doesn't
not.
Matter. We're doing it because we caught ourselves in our pants like down during the pandemic and we don't want to be there anymore.
And I'm not mad that this HBCUs are getting, like I said, I prefaced all of it by saying I'm not mad we're getting the money. But, to Saray's point, she said the right solutions for the wrong reasons. And it's, again, by not actually admitting the wrongdoing and holding yourself accountable to that wrongdoing, the behavior doesn't necessarily change. This is just, some sort of stopgap solution that we need, and you need Black folks to help you clean up, because you weren't ready and got caught with your pants down when we had this pandemic. And so, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, however, when the money runs out or when you just decide that you no longer want to cut that check, you're not cutting the check and nobody's, being held accountable for that. So it just, stuff doesn't get fixed if you don't acknowledge that it was broken in the first place.
So here's just one quote that I actually pulled out. Federal government data has found that HBCUs have been underfunded for decades, in some cases intentionally so, to the point of not being able to compete. This is coming from federal reports and, in findings that they have had. So I believe that at least this particular administration is admitting that, yes, we have not held up our end of the bargain.
I don't believe it.
But once again,
I don't believe it. It says a report found. It didn't say the United States government
admitted. You know what? Because when they admit to it,
for doing this,
no, that's never going to happen. That is never going to happen.
Therein lies the problem.
Because as soon as that happens, the big R word is coming after that. When you admit that you've actually done something wrong, then the R word comes after that. That is not happening. So, like I said, a broke clock is wrong. For 22 hours, but for that 1 hour a day that it is right, for that one moment a day that it is right, I will take the win here if some of this $5 billion that just got allocated last week goes to HBCUs, something that HBCUs are already saying, hey, we need to figure out what we got to do to get some of this money. If the government is saying, it's like, yeah, it looks like you've got to figure it out, maybe we can work something out. I am eager to see how those things turn out. I don't want to put a wet towel over that before we even know what's going to happen.
I believe it when the check clear. Put it like that.
Right. Yeah. Cut the check.
So, y'all, we are going to get ready to wrap our show up. But before we do, as we said, for the last several weeks now, we're going to do a spotlight every week in February, just because it is Black History Month. So this one, we're going to be talking about. Longtime listeners of the Tech John may have heard us talk about Jerry Lawson, also known as the father of gaming, because he was one of the first. It was one of the first spotlights that we did way back in November of 2021. We want to give Jerry his flowers again and talk just a bit about the ridiculous contributions he made to the gaming industry. So as I said, we did talk about him before, and we can, we'll link in our show notes to where you can go look at that full bio of where he grew up and where he went to college and stuff like that. But with Mr. Lawson, Nelson and his team at Fairchild Semiconductor did. They revolutionized the video game industry, and they have three key innovations. The first one was the pause button. So I just asked her, I was like, can you imagine playing a video game that you can't actually stop in the middle of the game, go get yourself a drink, go get yourself situated, then come back and finish playing the game? That didn't exist before Jerry Lawson's team said, you know what, we might want to allow people to pause these games. The second thing that he came up with was a joystick with eight directions of movement. So once again, we're going way back into the mid-70s, with this. Joysticks back then, they oftentimes were just dials. They were analog dials where you could turn a dial and move a slider one way or the other. He actually came up with a joystick that had eight different directions that you could push this thing when no other joystick had more than four. And then the big thing that Mr. Lawson and his team came up with was the game cartridge. And that literally fundamentally changed everything. I was thinking back to, when I was really, really young, my uncle had a game. I don't believe it was the actual Pong game from Atari, but it was a Pong clone. And I remember playing that when I was like 5-6 years old. And the game, you literally just hooked it up to the TV and turned the game on and you played Pong. That was all. I think his game had two pieces to it. It was Pong, and there was like this tank game that was kind of Pong like, to where you could just shoot and bounce stuff through and try to shoot another tank. But that's all that the whole game console did. It did just those two games. And when you got done playing that, you unhooked it from the TV and you put your rubber beers back on and you would go back to watching, watching whatever it is you watched. So what Mr. Lawson and his team did, they came up with the game cartridge that we all, if you're a certain age, everybody knows the game cartridge. It was made famous.
The sound it makes when you blow in it to get
blow to get in it, to work. Tap it, rub it to heat it up, tap it on your leg, all the stuff we used to have to do. But that came from a computer system called the Fairchild Channel F. The Channel F stood for Channel Fun. And it was a game that came pre-installed with two games on the console, like old school games, but then you could buy, I believe it had 9 games it released when it first came out. And those games were like $20 a piece in addition to the console, which it was expensive back in the day, but it was only like $170 at JCPenney. That's where you would pick this up. Now, the Fairchild F didn't really do all that well. It basically got mollywopped by that thing called the Atari 2600, as we know it today. Back then it was called the Atari VCS. That came out a year later. The Fairchild F came out in 1976. Then the Atari VCS, which is now the 2600, came out in 77, and it just took over. It had better games, better game developers that were creating games for it, and it kind of just, as I said, mollywopped the Fairchild. But that doesn't mean that the dude and the team that invented it was not named Jerry Lawson and worked right at Fairchild Semiconductor. So in 1980, Mr. Lawson left Fairchild to found VideoSoft. It was a video game development company that made software for the Atari 2600 in the early 80s. And then it shut down in 85. And then after that, he basically became a consultant flying under the radar. He did a couple things where he was trying to build like a clock that would wake you up with your voice. He was working with Stevie Wonder on that. So he stayed active until he retired around 2003, when he started suffering from complications of diabetes. And he was honored by the International Game Developers Association for his contributions to the industry before passing away at the age of 70 on April 9th, 2011. So once again, we want to talk about, or this spotlight should say, we're talking about Jerry Lawson, the father of modern gaming. And today we don't really use cartridges and stuff like that anymore, but I know I'm old enough to remember. I had an Atari 2600. Mm-hmm. I had a ColecoVision. I had an Intellivision. When I say it was like multiple family members, and we each had our own console that we would get, every other year or so. But
and I
that's
still have
how games work.
A Game Boy somewhere around here with a little Tetris cartridge that goes in the back of it. So,
I still have a functioning Nintendo 64 and probably 40 games for it. I definitely have a Game Boy, and I probably have 15 or 20 games for my Game Boy. Not the original Game Boy. It's like a Game Boy Advance or something like that. One of the, more recent ones. That's all due to game cartridges.
Shout out to Jerry Lawson.
Yeah. So with that, y'all, we're going to go ahead and get ready to wrap up the show. Before we do, I want to to let you know that if you would like to support the Tech John and look cool while you're doing it, you can do so by heading over to thetechjohn.com/shop, where you'll find all kinds of swag. We've got hats and hoodies, t-shirts, mugs, mice pads, tumblers, and more, all branded with our Tech John logo. Once again, head over to thetechjohn.com/shop and pick up yourself some of the new hotness that we just added a bit earlier this year. So with that being said, Tech Life Steph, tell the folks how they can get at you.
You can follow me all around the web at Tech Life Steph, or check out my website at stephaniehumphrey.com.
And you can find me all over the internet at Brother Tech. That's BROTHATECH.
And I am at Rob Dunwood on all the things. And we are also at The Tech John on all the things. So come holler at us however you holler. Until we meet again in a week's time. Peace. Peace.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.